You're listening to the Mining and Energy Union podcast.
Yes, indeed you are. Well, breathing in deadly dust, it's one of those things you need to be eternally vigilant about, especially since the re-emergence of black lung disease in the Queensland industry in 2015. Since then, MEU campaigning has delivered important improvements to legislation and practices in the state, including a reduction in exposure standards for coal dust, the mandatory reporting of dust monitoring data, and compulsory lung health screening for mine workers throughout their careers. But as I said, eternal vigilance is the only real weapon against black lung. That's why the Queensland District is holding a big conference on dust here in Cairns. In between sessions, I'm cornering people with my microphone to have a yak. There's doctors, researchers, academics, unionists from all over the world. Everywhere from South Africa to Albania, from Colombia and Indonesia to Mongolia. But also people from closer to home. Like Stuart Jameson, Vice President of the Moranbah North Lodge.
I've been at the Global Safety Conference the last couple of days in Cairns. There's been some really good conversation and a lot of good learnings about the fact that dust is still an issue and it's going to re-energise the conversation and bring it back to the forefront of health and safety at work.
Someone else I ran into during a lunch break was Clinical Professor Robert Cohen. He's a medical doctor and world expert on lung diseases. Professor, can you tell us what are the diseases we're looking out for when we say black lung? What are we talking about?
Yeah, when we talk about black lung, that's the term that we've used a lot in the United States. It's a broad term that covers a whole range of diseases that coal miners can get if they're overexposed to coal mine dust. And one of the ones that people know the most about is called pneumoconiosis, which means the lung gets scarred from breathing in these dusts that are toxic to the lung. The lung doesn't like them and can't really get rid of it all, and so that it starts to have an inflammatory effect or irritation in the lungs, which causes scarring. And the scars in the lungs can be round, and they can be sometimes irregular, and they can actually be a lot of them. And when it gets really profuse, lots and lots of those scars, they can even be larger and larger in size. It can cause a fair amount of lung damage. So that's called coal workers' pneumoconiosis, and the most severe form of that, which we've seen a fair amount recently in the States, is called progressive massive fibrosis. And that's when any one of those scars gets bigger than 1 centimeter, and sometimes they can be much larger than that. They're basically destroying the lung and taking over the lung and replacing that normal, nice, spongy lung tissue with dense scar tissue that just doesn't work and doesn't exchange oxygen and get rid of carbon dioxide, and people can't breathe. So that's one. The other broad category of diseases is when it causes obstructive lung diseases, and the abbreviation for that is COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases. And that includes things like emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And probably most people think about those diseases, they just think about tobacco smoke, people who are smokers getting those diseases. But what many don't realize is that coal mine dust can cause those diseases as well. And chronic bronchitis is when people breathe in this dust, or if they were smokers, they get it from smoke as well. And it causes swelling and inflammation of the airways and irritation of the airways. And oftentimes those airways can secrete a lot of mucus, more mucus than normal, in order to try to protect the airway. But that causes swelling and narrowing of the airways, and so that people can't breathe the air in and out as normally as they should, because the airways are so narrow. And if you cough and you spit up phlegm for most days of the week for at least 3 months out of the year for 2 consecutive years, you've met the definition of chronic bronchitis. And the air obstruction that comes from that is a real serious problem. The other disease that's part of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is called emphysema. And I like to use the analogy that emphysema is like Swiss cheese lung. There's holes in the lung where the normal spongy lung tissue is just gone because the lung has digested it. When you breathe in those dusts, or if you're exposed to smoke, your lung is trying to get rid of it and digest it, and it ends up kind of digesting your normal lung tissue. So you've got lots and lots of big holes in your lungs, and your lungs, therefore, because they don't have that spongy supporting tissue, the airways collapse very easily, which also causes obstruction. And sometimes people really have features of both when they have COPD. They've got damage to their airways with swelling and mucus production and narrowed airways, or they have holes in their lungs and collapsing airways, and they really can't breathe very well at all. And that group of diseases is probably one of the most common forms of coal mine dust lung disease that results in people having serious problems, maybe needing oxygen, not being able to breathe. So those are the two broad categories, the scarring lung diseases and the obstructive lung diseases that cause significant impairment. There's a few other things that can occur as a result of coal mine dust exposure. People can have a form of scarring lung disease that looks like something that in the population we would call pulmonary fibrosis, and the term in the general population we use is idiopathic, which means we don't have a clue as to what causes it. But when a miner gets it, when they're exposed to lots of dust, we do know what causes it, and we call that a dust-related diffuse fibrosis. So that kind of scarring is sometimes mistaken by doctors in the community who don't know about the person's exposure, that they were a coal miner. They can get that dust fibrosis, and the doctors in the community might call it idiopathic, meaning they don't know what caused it, but we actually jokingly say it's idiotpathic, because the doctors should have really gone and asked the person what they did for a living and found out that they were exposed to coal mine dust and got that fibrosis from that. And coal mine dust has been associated with lung cancer because there are carcinogens in the coal mine atmosphere. So you can actually get an occupational lung cancer from the silica in the dust, and also people working in mines are exposed to diesel exhaust particulate, and that's a carcinogen. So those are the main serious consequences to the lungs of coal mine dust exposure.
Yes, it's interesting that you're breaking that down a little bit further too and saying, look, there's coal mine dust, but there's also fumes, diesel fumes, and silica as well. Look, I know that you say that we need to approach this sort of on three levels when it comes to, I suppose, an institutional response. You need to have miners themselves and unions involved. You need to have government and regulators involved. And you need to have miners, mine operators involved as well. But I sort of want to get to the way that you sort of break this down in terms of that prevention, that medical surveillance, and then also treatments and compensation. Can we start with primary prevention? Because you've got some really strong things to say about how that's done, and making sure that it's done independently and so on, and the different kinds of ways primary prevention, which I suppose is the most important, can be done. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, primary prevention is the most important thing, because you want to never have this disease develop in anybody. They should be able to go to work, work their 30 or 40 years and go home without having any lung disease. So primary prevention means that we are controlling the dust in the mines and keeping it at a low level so that it's safe and that people working in that atmosphere won't ever get disease. And the ways to do that is to, number one is engineering controls, that the mine operators and the mining engineers and industrial hygienists who work with a company need to institute ventilation to keep clean, fresh air and dilute out any dust that's generated when you're cutting coal or cutting the rock that's above and below the coal. You also need to have water suppression is another technology where there are sprays on these cutting machines that knock the dust down and keep it out of the air so that the miner doesn't breathe it. There are suction devices that are used to very close to the point of cutting to suck up all the air. And these are some of the techniques that are used to make sure that the dust isn't in the atmosphere that the miner is breathing. In surface mines, it's really important for the operators of these huge trucks and the cabs on the drills and the other heavy equipment that's used there, that those cabs where the miner is actually sitting and operating are sealed, pressurized, and that the air filtration in those cabs ensures that no dust gets in there. And we've seen that often that may not happen, and the surface miners or people working on that type of equipment may not be fully protected. So primary prevention really is up to the mining engineers, and it's up to the mine operators. And then the industrial hygienists are those guys, men and women, that go in, sample in the mines. They have devices that they use so that they can actually measure what is the concentration of these contaminants or these toxic dusts in the atmosphere, and is it safe to work there? For example, the two types of sampling, and I would like to just let your audience know that I am not an industrial hygienist or a mining engineer. Mm. So I'm a kind of a well-educated amateur in these respects, but the sampling devices are pumps that are often used. The miner wears it on his belt, and they have a little tube right near his breathing or her breathing zone that sucks in the air, sometimes across a filter and sometimes across a device that will give a real-time reading for how much dust is in the air. And either then the filter is sent in and measured to see how much coal dust or respirable dust there is on it, and how much silica dust might be there. And when I use the term respirable, what it means is that the dust is small enough that it can penetrate into the lung and get deeply down into the lung where it can cause some damage. So that's really important that the mine control the dust in the atmosphere, that they sample either individual sampling with the miners. They may combine it with what we call area sampling, where they have devices on the machines near where the cutting is taking place, and they're continuously sampling what's going on in the atmosphere near those machines. But really monitoring and checking to make sure that the levels of respirable coal dust and silica dust in the air are really at very, very low levels, below the exposure limits, so that miners are protected.
I love what you say about making sure that testing and sampling, when it's done, is done during usual production conditions and not at other times, and also that you're doing independent sampling and it's not just the company who's running the mine doing it or company hired contractors.
Right. Well, we've had a number of problems in the States where the sampling is not representative of reality. So, for example, a sample might be taken when the mine is really operating at half or very, very low production. Or it may be that the miner is concerned, and there may be threats of retribution, or they may get in trouble if they have, quote, a bad sample. So the miner may put the pump in an area that's clean instead of wearing it throughout the day where they are working in the dust in order to avoid getting a bad sample. We feel that if you have independent sampling by government inspectors or by people that are not necessarily only paid by the companies, who might be therefore having an incentive to make sure the sampling comes out good, having independent sampling may be the best way to do it, and making sure that it really represents the everyday exposures that the miners have. So that's the most important thing with sampling, that it be done frequently, that it be done well, that it's accurate, and that it's unbiased, so that we can know that, in fact, the atmosphere in the mine is safe.
Let's talk a bit now about medical surveillance. You've talked about primary prevention and trying to make sure that dust never gets into people's lungs. I suppose the next step, as you would see it, would be that medical surveillance and making sure that's as beefed up and as strong as it can possibly be. There's two sort of areas to this that I'm getting from listening to you, and that is you got the sort of spirometry test and you've also got x-rays of the chest itself or chest radiography. Can you give us a bit more detail on those two processes?
Yeah, no, medical surveillance is part of what we call secondary prevention. So if we haven't prevented disease, we may have people that are developing disease. And secondary prevention or surveillance is trying to find whether or not there's any disease and getting it early, finding out the very first signs of disease so that we can intervene and protect that worker from having a progressive disease and having severe disease. It's not great if we find somebody with a very advanced end stage of the disease. There's really nothing we can do about it. But if we can find it early, then we can put that worker back to work, hopefully in less dust or low dust conditions. Or if necessary, if we're really concerned about that worker, we would remove them from exposure. And those two, the two methods that we use for lung disease in dust-exposed workers are some lung function tests, one of which is called spirometry, one of the most important ones. And that's a test where the workers breathe in and out of a machine that measures how big their lungs are, but really importantly, how quickly and how much air comes out of the lungs in the first second of blowing out as hard and as fast as they can. And that measurement is actually called the FEV1, or forced expiratory volume in 1 second. And I often tell workers that they should know their FEV1 just like they might know their blood pressure or cholesterol reading. It's the most important measurement from spirometry. And we really want to have them do a good test breathing on that machine. And we would check them throughout their working lives and making sure that that FEV1, which reflects their lung function and how good and strong their lungs are, that stays in a good normal reference range. If we find that that number is dropping, it means that something is either damaging the airways of in your lungs or causing scarring in your lungs. And we want to catch that early. So we certainly want to make sure that it's normal. But even within normal, we want to make sure that it's not falling down too quickly. So that's spirometry, breathing in and out of a machine that's a portable type of machine and is available in many clinics and doctor's offices. And actually on the mobile truck unit that you have here in Australia. And you asked about the other important screening technique, and that's chest imaging, looking at your chest x-ray and trying to see if there's any scars that are developing on the lung as a result of breathing in too much dust. And the chest x-ray has to be done really well at a very good quality. And then the people who are looking at that chest x-ray to see if there's any scars on the chest x-ray have to be well-trained because they're looking for very subtle and early changes. Anybody can see when there's a massive scar on the lung, but by then it's really quite late. And the process for this medical surveillance is to catch it early, to get that person away from the dust or in reduced dust. And so that chest imaging must be done well, and it must be done by highly trained doctors, and we really recommend that it be read by two different doctors and making sure they agree with each other, two different radiologists and people trained to do it, so that we can really make sure that x-ray is clear and that there's that it's safe for that person to continue working.
Yes, I really love how you say that these tests, this particular test, you know, x-raying the chest, should be classified or read by or to ILO standards by someone who's trained specifically in this rather than perhaps a generalist. And as you say, go a bit further there and say, look, you know, even get someone else in. So you've got a couple of people looking at it because we really want to catch anything before it can really get a chance to take hold. Just quickly, I've heard you talk about some stuff that might be happening in the future with the sort of breathing side of things. I think you've talked about diffusion testing, and I know you've also talked about high resolution CT scanning when it comes to the chest. Can you tell us what those are and when we might sort of see them being rolled out?
Yeah, sure. Diffusion testing is really an easy test to do. It actually can be quite portable and can be done very well at the same time that spirometry is done. And that test has you inhaling a test gas, and it measures how well the body transfers gas from the air sacs in the lung into the bloodstream, which is really the most important function of the lung, to take oxygen out of the air and get it into your blood and get carbon dioxide out of the blood and get rid of it. And so this diffusion test is really been around for 40, 50, 60 years, really. And now we have very compact, portable units that can be used. And it does give you the earliest indication of when somebody might be developing scarring in their lungs and when somebody might be developing emphysema. So it really detects both of them very, very well. And we really think it should be added to surveillance. Now, not a lot of countries are doing this or places are doing it. The Heart of Australia van does have it on it, but it's not required as part of the health scheme for coal mine workers or for minerals, mines, and quarry workers in Queensland. But we think the technology exists, it's been around a long time, and it should be used. So we're very strong advocates for this. And I think in New South Wales, for example, they have these devices, and they're considering using it in their screening program there. So we think it's long overdue. The other thing you asked me about is high-resolution CT scanning. And CT scanning is a three-dimensional view of the lungs. And it's been around also for 45, 50 years. But now it's become much cheaper. It is portable, so that there is actually a portable CT scanner on your truck here in Queensland. And you can get a three-dimensional view of the lung, and it's much more sensitive than just plain chest X-ray. The problem with it in the past has been that it had more radiation exposure and was more expensive. Both the radiation and the costs are coming down, approaching that of a regular chest X-ray. There is one problem with it, and that there is no system like the ILO system of classification that's been completely certified, and that there's testing for and training for in an organized way, so that the physicians that are reading those scans don't really have the same type of classification system and training that they do for plain chest X-ray. So that is something that needs to be fixed. But I think that if we started getting more experience with high-resolution CT scanning, we could do that. But we're still waiting for that classification system and for testing and training of radiologists and chest physicians in that system.
Yes, you're listening to clinical professor Robert Cohen. That's the voice that you're hearing. And he's talking about medical surveillance when it comes to lung diseases. I love how you talk about that nexus between this surveillance being confidential and in some countries and in some situations, just making sure that, you know, it's between the worker and the medical provider, and it's not going to third parties, mine owners and so on. Can we move on to treatment and compensation quickly? Because I think you've looked all around the world at this, and I think it's fair to say Australia's doing pretty well in terms of its response to this, but maybe contrast it with countries where they don't do such a great job.
Yes, Tim, there is one thing I wanted to mention about the surveillance, and that is that the surveillance is really important for identifying the early diseases I mentioned and getting people out of dust or less dust, but it's critical in feeding back on whether your primary prevention is working. So if you do good secondary surveillance, you've got to collect that data, and somebody has to have all of those results and look at it and see where the failures are occurring. So it's not just important for the individual miner who might have early disease, but it's important feedback to those mines that may be sicker mines or workplaces that may be sicker workplaces to identify them and go back and fix their primary prevention.
It's so important, isn't it, the idea that you've got that central collection and analysis of data so that you can, as you say, see if there are particular cohorts within a group of workers or in a mine who are having issues, and you can compare and contrast that data. It's not just the person's data, it's about the group. Yes, absolutely, you're quite right. Look, let's talk about then the compensation and so on and treatment. I think that we do it very well here in Australia. Obviously, we've got universal health, and I think there's a strong sense that we know that compensation, it will be a lifelong thing. It's not going to be just a couple of years. Maybe you could quickly contrast that with some of the other countries, because I know that some of them do a very poor job.
That's right. In the United States, for example, the compensation system is adversarial. So every case is a lawsuit. The coal mine operator that was the last place that person worked for 1 year defends the claim and tries to not have to pay that claim. So there's a fair amount of pressure on the miner to get examined and then to establish that their lung disease is from their exposure, and they have to prove that their lung disease is disabling. And the coal company can also hire expert physicians and others to say that it's not. That it's not disabling, or oftentimes they may try to say that it's not caused by the worker's occupational exposure, it's caused by something else. So it's a difficult process in the States and can often take 10 years or more for someone to get compensation. Unfortunately, we have often situations where the miner may have even passed away before they receive compensation, and then their surviving spouse has to fight for that compensation. Many countries have a simple lump sum payment, and it can be very, very difficult to prove it. In South Africa, for example, for silica gold miners, silica-exposed gold miners, for many years there was no compensation. And in South Africa, there's that horrendous history of apartheid and discrimination against black workers, and they had no ability to get compensated. There was a lawsuit in South Africa by miners against the industry in order to get compensation, and there was a large settlement a few years ago.
Large is definitely appropriate way to describe it. $5 billion large.
Right, $5 billion large, although in speaking with the National Union of Miners from South Africa, they point out that that covers miners from 1960s all the way forward, and it also covers miners from many countries. They had a lot of workers who would immigrant workers that would come to South Africa and work, but then would go back to Malawi, other countries, and therefore they're not really having a hard time finding them and getting covered. So it's a maximum of $70,000 per case, and they're concerned that out of that $5 billion, you know, $0.8 billion is being used for administration of that process. So it's really only $4.2 billion for the workers, and that it may not last that long. But at any rate, it's still a big victory for them.
It really does underline, though, that while we might have a handle on some of these things here, that in other countries it's rampant, and there's a lot of commonalities, especially when you consider that it's the same companies operating in the different jurisdictions, and it's just more evidence that we just need to keep our guard up. I believe that there has been a big black lung lawsuit filed against South32 in the coal mining sector just in August last year.
That's right. That's my understanding. For the previous lawsuit in South Africa was really just covering silicosis and gold miners. But this lawsuit is the first attempt to recover compensation for coal miners. And we're really interested to see how that lawsuit will play out. And I think some of the coal companies in South Africa are actually gearing up to do exams and then maybe work on a process to compensate miners for coal workers' pneumoconiosis there.
Look, just finally, before we go, of course, the metalliferous mining is a big industry in Australia as well. We've got gold and silver and even uranium. Do they have similar problems with dust, and how is that different?
We call it minerals mines and quarry workers, I believe, in Queensland. And in the States, we call it metal non-metal mining. And they have huge problems with silica. So they don't actually have the coal dust, and they may not have the same risks of explosion and fire that coal mines do. But the silica dust in those mines is extremely toxic. Silica is probably 20 times more toxic than coal. And they're cutting through rock, they're crushing rock, they're drilling rock, they're blasting. So they're creating very fine respirable crystalline silica, which is a huge problem. It causes all the diseases that we talked about for coal mine workers, the scarring in the lungs, the progressive massive fibrosis. It causes COPD, the emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And you must do the same kind of surveillance of this workforce that you are planning to do for coal miners. Unfortunately, I would say, while exams are now mandated in Queensland and in other parts of Australia, the central data collection and looking at that population isn't quite as strong as it should be. There's no real requirement that results of those exams be reported centrally. So it's going to be a bit tough to see where the problems are. You can help the individual workers, but that secondary feedback to the, you know, preventing this disease isn't quite as strong as it should be.
I know you've got a lot to say as well about enforcement, but the process around, how we deal with this stuff, as well as the medical side, you know, demanding the right to know, demanding the right to participate and find out the information as it's coming through in terms of testing, and also the right to refuse unsafe work and how that flows into industrial relations and the use of contractors and so on. But I think, look, we've taken up so much of your time already, and we really appreciate it. If we want more information, if we've enjoyed listening to that and want to get a bit more detail, where would you recommend looking online?
People can look at our website at the University of Illinois in Chicago. That's called UIC. And if you look up the UIC Miner Center. That stands for Mining Education and Research Center. Google that and look there. You'll see a lot of resources there. And then just Googling any of these diseases will bring you to a lot of good information websites. The Miners Health Queensland is a good site. The U.S. National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, is also a good site.
Well, Clinical Professor Robert Cohen, thank you so much for having EAC to us.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Emeritus Professor Michael Quinlan there. Well, as well as people from overseas and the world of academia, there are many familiar faces at this Dust Conference in Cairns. Some you've heard on the podcast before. Jason Hill is the Industry Safety and Health Representative for the Mining and Energy Union Queensland District.
Dust Conference has been a great conference. It's probably one of the best conferences I've been to. One key message that has come out of it is education and training. We need to educate and train our workers at the face to respect the dust. You know, that we can work with it. There are controls to put into place to reduce dust exposure, but workers need to be able to respect the dust and, you know, and not be exposed to unacceptable levels of dust.
Another familiar face and regular on the podcast is Steve Smythe, who is now the National Vice President and has been deeply involved with the campaign to protect coal workers from dust diseases. Steve, it really does seem to me this Dust Conference is showing the leadership of the union, because we do seem to be, as an industry, leading the world when it comes to combating black lung. Case in point, here we are with miners from all over the world coming to learn from us, from Colombia, from Mongolia, from Indonesia, from South Africa, from Albania, from the USA. This is really about leadership and spreading the message and a bit of old-fashioned global solidarity, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. This is what global solidarity is all about. There is no doubt the Mining and Energy Union is at the top of its game when it comes to health and safety. There's always room for improvement, but I believe we're the leaders. I believe that through our leadership across the board, across our districts and nationally, that we can provide what workers are looking for. And I mean that by being able to bring people together like we have from all around the world, you know, doctors, academics, researchers, scientists, hygienists. We bring together regulators from right across Australia, and then we bring the global unions from Albania, from Colombia, from South Africa, Pakistan, India, Indonesia, and of course the United States. So we've been able to, because of our leadership, but also the global solidarity we've built up over decades, provide a platform for people to come together to talk about the issues and at the end of the day come out with outcomes and actions that can drive a campaign forward, both at a state level, a national level and a global level.
Since 2015, I think especially in your sort of home state of Queensland, and we saw black lung redetected, if you like, there's actually quite a few markers that you've already been able to get up there, you know, halving workplace exposure and so on. Can you tell us about some of the things you've already done, you know, I suppose in your home state, that are already, I suppose, world leading?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that we had an emergency situation where, in fact, we had an epidemic of disease. You know, for a long time, we believed we eradicated black lung. We were telling the world we eradicated black lung. And meanwhile, we were sitting on top of, as I said, an epidemic, but on top of a disaster. And in my view, one worker getting diagnosed with a health disease or respiratory disease is one too many. And when it came about, and then we suddenly realised that we had this problem, we had to act. And as unions do, we acted with an immediate campaign. And the campaign centred not just around one thing, but it centred around a various number of other matters. And we knew we had to fix our health screening, our health surveillance, our dust monitoring, our enforcement, our dust levels. But more importantly, we also had to not forget about those of the past, those miners of the past who have been affected by this disease, which is a legacy disease. So we implemented a lot of reform, and there is no doubt about it. That reform would not have come about unless we had the solidarity global solidarity, but also the ability to tap into and utilise the evidence and data that was being provided and the reforms that have occurred elsewhere around the world. Now, we went from a situation of, in Queensland, no doubt, of a system that had failed. We'd been failed by doctors, by the regulator, by governments, and more, and most evidently by the coal companies. So we had to fix that. I believe the reforms we undertook were world-leading, and they are world-leading, because those reforms now are spoken about around the world and held up as best practice. And in saying that, we can never ever let rest on our laurels. We can't take our foot off the throttle, and there's some other reform that Queensland needs to do. But I'm really confident in saying that some of our reforms in Queensland can be spread across the rest of the sectors, and there's some work being done in Tasmania, for example, on a safety steering committee I sit on down there on behalf of the MEU with the Tasmanian District. And we're looking at coal miners down there about health surveillance, and we're also then looking at a code of practice across the rest of the mining sector. So there is no doubt that once we identified what needed to be done and we commenced the reform program, we then rolled out our campaign, which included each and every one of our members engaged, understanding what was at stake, and more importantly, their families and the community. So I'm really, really proud of that. But I'm also a big believer in about further reform and about never ever letting your foot off the throttle. Because as soon as you take your eye off it, and we're only talking about dust now and respiratory health, then what was previously in place, which were the fires, can happen again. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of hazards in mining, there's plenty of other issues to deal with, but we've got to get this right because workers deserve to retire with dignity and respect, and most importantly, their health.
There you go, Steve Smythe. Well, it's been a great dust conference here in Cairns. I hope you enjoyed just a bit of a taste of it. By the way, this is our 50th episode, so we must be doing something right. Thanks for all your support and for tuning in over the last 4 years. I'm Tim Brunero. Talk to you next time.